that Donald Trump announcing that it was a ceasefire right after he announced it. Israel attacked Iran. Then Iran attacked Israel in the last minutes of ceasefire coming in effect. What has happened? What's your take on what has happened?
Israel thought, A, that this war would be short and quick. They thought they had the decapitation strike in place. Shock and awe would collapse the regime. That didn't work. They were hoping that their ballistic missile defense shield, together with American assistance, would be able to prevent significant damage being done to Israel. They're wrong. Israel got pounded like it's never been pounded before. And the harm was real, devastating. We don't know the extent to which, because Israel has, you know, of course, put on a media blackout. But when the final reporting is done, you'll see the Iranians were very effective at hitting Israel, as effective at hitting Israel as Israel was to hit Iran, or maybe even more so. And the Israelis just couldn't continue this conflict politically. And so both nations were desperate for the ceasefire. But because neither nation was defeated, both nations have to posture as if they've somehow prevailed. This is a psychological game being played right now. And that's important to point out, because that psychological game, you know, serves as the foundation of going forward. I think most people, I know you have, and me as well, have taken a deep sigh of relief that there's a ceasefire in place. But the confidence of the ceasefire holding is not high on my part, because there are too many unresolved issues and too much ego, national pride, the ego of the biggest egomaniac in the world, Donald Trump. And then, of course, the narcissistic tendencies of Benjamin Netanyahu. So, you know, we're not out of the woods yet, but why don't we just go ahead and take a deep breath and say, the bombing has stopped, the missiles have stopped, and that's a good thing for the moment.
Just letting the situation unravel this, the way it unraveled under the Trump administration and his policy in the Middle East. What was the outcome for Donald Trump? What was the outcome for the administration? When you look at the attack, when you look at the way that they led Israel attack in Iran.
In order to know that, we have to know what the genuine, you know, intention is of Donald Trump in this regard. We can be guided, or at least I thought we could be guided, by statements he made last September while he was still candidate Trump about, you know, how he was looking for, there's a deal to be made with Iran that can lift the sanctions and move forward. But I think what we found is that Donald Trump is, the entanglement with Israel is real. He can't disentangle from Israel. He can't disengage from Israel. And so he was sort of in a trap, an Israeli trap with Iran. And he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't. His base was political base was primarily composed of people who were seeking non-military intervention. And yet the people he surrounded him with, his political power core, were pro-Zionist, pro-Israeli elements who believed that Iran must be confronted decisively, up to and including force. And so Donald Trump was stuck in the middle there. In retrospect, people may come out and say that he was a genius in the way that he navigated these troubled waters. Because if you think about it, what military price did the United States pay for bombing Iran? None. Just the cost of the attack. No lives lost. The Iranian retaliation was as politically motivated as Trump's attack. Trump bombed 3 empty sites. Whether he telegraphed his intent to the Iranians or not, we don't know at this stage. We know that we know that the Iranians telegraphed their intent. Iran wasn't looking to kill Americans, and America wasn't looking to kill Iranians. But Trump needed to be seen as being willing to bomb Iran and to have taken that step. And so this is why you get all the rhetoric about the most magnificent destructive obliteration in the world. We are the greatest thing, B-2 bombers, medals around the necks. But at the end of the day, it was pure political theater. just an act of political theater, as was the Iranian retaliation. And what's interesting is right after that occurred, it's as if there couldn't be a ceasefire until they checked off these boxes. The United States had to check off the "we bombed Iran" box, and Iran had to check off the "we attacked American installations" box. And then suddenly Qatar is making phone, or I guess Qatar, who made phone calls, and Iran's going, "Yep, we're willing to do this ceasefire thing." And the Israelis are like, "Please make this happen. We really need this to happen." So I think it was front loaded. I think the talk about a ceasefire, the how to make this happen, was front loaded, which means that what Trump did in bombing these sites was designed to create the conditions for a ceasefire, one that would be politically acceptable in the United States, one that would be politically acceptable in Israel, and created the conditions for political acceptance in Iran. If that's the case, then Trump, deserves credit for his actions. I mean, we saw in the past with North Korea, his fire and brimstone, fire and fury. I'm going to nuke you off the face of the earth, moving things around. And even when he was engaged in actual diplomacy with North Korea, he tends to put out social media postings that are childlike. I mean, that's why I call him a man child, because the way he postures himself is not that of a mature, dignified, sophisticated leader. This is a very intellectually not complicated, the way he talks in all caps and using words and such, but it's effective, meaning that it accomplished the task. So I think, the jury's still out, but we have a ceasefire. And now what Trump needs to do is bring an end to this nuclear nonsense. I don't think he's going to be able to sustain the 0% enrichment. I think he knows that. Remember, when Steve Witkoff began the negotiations, which were clearly just a setup for this knockout punch, Marco Rubio has admitted that. March 7th, he said the decision was made to attack. That's a decision, joint decision by the United States and Israel. April 14th is when the first round of negotiations took place. So the United States knew going into the negotiations it was a setup. I mean, I don't know how we recover from that. But Witkoff, I don't think, knew. I think Witkoff was actually trying to negotiate in good faith. And then Witkoff got off script because he got a deal. Hey, we're going to have a deal. 3.75% enriched cap. We're ready to go. And Trump was like, "Well, that's a pretty cool deal." But then Trump remembered, "Oh, damn, yeah, we got to bomb Iran. Zero enrichment, zero this, zero that." Now, if we want to go forward, I don't think you get Iran to come back into the fold with 0%, with zero enrichment. I think there has to be a compromise. And is the United States and Israel ready to accept such a compromise? So that's the next hurdle that has to be crossed, is resolving the thing. But Iran has a lot of latitude here, because the attacks did not diminish Iran's potential. In fact, if anything, Iran is more dangerous today than they were before the attacks began, because the 60% enriched uranium has not been destroyed. The centrifuges, the IR-6, IR-8 advanced centrifuges, have not been destroyed. Those cascades can be reestablished in secrecy, because Iran, I believe that the parliament voted to break relations with the IAEA. I don't know if the government's acted on that yet. But, as Lavrov said, there's no reason for Iran to tell the IAEA where the 60% enrichment is, because the IAEA will just turn it over to the Israelis and the Americans, who will bomb. So Iran actually has a stronger position. It now, if it wanted to, could, in a very short period of time, produce enough highly enriched uranium. And I believe that they preserved much, or at least what was needed for at least pilot plant production of uranium metal conversion, that they can enrich the 60% enriched uranium to 90, 92%, convert it to metal, and make a simple gun design that can go on a missile. So if the goal was to ensure that Iran couldn't have a nuclear weapon, they failed. The only thing that's lacking right now is Iran's political. And I apologize for the dogs, but we got people moving out in front of the house. The only thing lacking right now is the political will. And this is what Trump needs to capitalize on right now, is to cut a deal as quick as possible while Iran is willing to cut a deal. But if you push Iran into a corner, even the Russians have said publicly, you know, there's no telling what they're going to do. You know, the Russians are no longer saying Iran can't have a nuclear weapon. They're saying, because of you, Iran probably will have a nuclear weapon. And so I think we have to act quick. We, being the United States, have to act quick to cut a deal that brings this under control before it gets out of control. And this is something, you know, the Israelis, you know, didn't count upon. They, you know, the fact that they failed. And they didn't just fail there. On ballistic missiles, they failed. Iran still has a considerable stockpile of these missiles. Many of them are the advanced models. And yes, while they destroyed certain infrastructure, you know, the bottom line is Iran will be able to pour concrete, move dirt, you know, install steel beams, and reestablish production capacity. They know how to do it. The hard part isn't the facility. The hard part is the knowledge. And Iran has the knowledge. So, you know, they will be able to reconstitute ballistic missile production. So this is a failure for Israel across the board, but it's also a failure for Iran, because did Iran establish deterrence, a deterrence standard sufficient to have the Israelis say, we never want to do this again? And I think in the short term right now, the answer is no. But when Israel lifts the media blackout, and the truth becomes apparent, let's see what happens to the political fallout. Let's see what happens in Benjamin Netanyahu has to tell the Israeli people the extent to which the damage has been done. And that may prove to be a constraint for Israel, you know, seeking to go forward and continue to attack. So we're in a difficult period of time. Leadership is required. The United States should be the one to step forward. Can the world trust? Can Iran trust? Can anybody trust the United States after what has been done? Don't know.
I don't know if you saw the interview that John Kerry had with Christiane Amanpour, in which he said that the people in the administration, the Trump administration, need to understand the case of Iranian nuclear program is something related to their knowledge. They can reproduce it. They can make it. And but it seems the administration somehow feeling physically damaging these things that would bring, they can bring some sort of, I don't know, they can push it back. They can, but after all, it's 6 months, a year. How long does it take? It doesn't take that much to Iran to get back and reproduce everything. I think they need to understand this and find a permanent solution to what's going on. I don't know if anybody is willing to understand this.
I disagree with the notion that Iran's program has been pushed back 2 to 4 years. That's based upon an assessment derived from physical destruction of large facilities. Large facilities that, which for the most part, had been evacuated. You know, the Iranians, it's not like they woke up one day and said, oh my God, we got to evacuate. Iran was getting ready to open up a third major enrichment facility. That wasn't bombed. They still have the centrifuge cascades. That's underground too. That could be set up in a week. So now they take the 60% enriched uranium in there and they step it up. No inspections, no verification, no knowledge that this is being done. Now they have weapons grade uranium hexafluoride, and they bring in a pilot plant, and you know, they just need to convert, gosh, 90 kilograms to 90 pounds to metal. Once it's metal of that enrichment, the gun design, you know, the United States, it's just physics at that point in time. It's not sophisticated, it's just physics. We didn't test the uranium bomb that we dropped on the Japanese because we didn't need to test it because we knew it would work. So the Iranians won't have to do a test. Everybody's like, oh, we're waiting for the Iranian test. Why? It's a gun design. It's a gun design that will easily, that will probably, once it's all done, its configuration will weigh around 500 pounds. They have warheads that can carry 900 pounds. They have warheads even bigger than that, but on the Fahad 2, which is a maneuverable one that can almost guaranteed to hit its target, easily craft a functional gun design uranium weapon on that warhead. You know, so the idea that what the United States and Israel did made the world safer or made it more dangerous, because now the Iranians have every incentive to go down that path. So the program hasn't been pushed back or whatever. This is a fallacy. It's flawed thinking. And it actually plays to Iran's benefit, because if you actually believe that you have retarded or neutralized their capability for, 2 to 4 years, then your guard's down. Oh, we don't have to worry about it. Guys, you got to worry about it right now. That's why you need to immediately address this issue and get an agreement in place that gives Iran what it wants with that, and also removes from any possibility the notion of an Iranian nuclear weapon.
Here is, Scott, you mentioned the ballistic missiles of Iran being used, but the Israeli Channel 12 reported that Iran did not launch any cruise missiles at Israel during the war. It seems that these are much difficult to be intercepted. Why did they not use it? Because they didn't need it? They somehow felt that they can hit with other missiles? They don't need to use them? What was the main reason, in your opinion?
I don't know. I would speculate that these cruise missiles, I believe Iran had a war plan that they were implementing. They were working off of, a campaign strategy that had been planned, and they had assets dedicated to each level of the campaign, and that campaign could be expanded or contracted as necessary. If Iran says that they're preparing to hit American bases or they're preparing to hit regional oil production, you don't want to waste a ballistic missile on an oil field. Fire a cruise missile at the oil field. So maybe they were holding on to these cruise missiles for the infrastructure, oil infrastructure phase of the campaign. We don't know how this campaign was impacted by Israeli military actions. No plan survives initial contact with the enemy. That's just an old saying. And we don't know what Israel accomplished. I don't know if the Iranians will ever be honest about this, but, Israel did strike missile facilities throughout Iran, and some of those facilities were having secondary explosions and glow that suggested that Israel penetrated and there was a lot going underground. We don't know what's left of the Iranian arsenal. We don't know if a diminished arsenal helped persuade the Iranian government to, seek a ceasefire, because they weren't able to sustain this. Iran didn't launch any cruise missiles, but is that because they're all intact, or did Israel manage to penetrate some of these storage facilities and block that? We just don't know. What we do know is this: both Israel and Iran were desperate for the ceasefire. We know that because they both took it up. And so let's be honest here. If last week, in the midst of this conflict, if I said the United States attacks Iran, what do you expect to happen? Massive retaliation, right? And then after that massive retaliation, what do you expect to happen? More escalation, automatic. Would you at any moment a week ago said, no, what will happen is an immediate ceasefire? Do those two things lend themselves to a ceasefire under normal logic? And the answer is no. It lends itself to escalation. The fact that Iran immediately agreed to a ceasefire means there's a reason that they did this. They feel vulnerable. They're not achieving their objectives. And one of those could be that they have lost considerable assets. Or the fact that they don't have an air defense capable of protecting the Iranian people from Israeli attacks. Israel was starting to single out neighborhoods in Tehran for destruction. And if you can't protect it and you're the regime, you're saying, well, wait a minute. At some point in time, the people may turn against us because we can't protect them. And I also believe that the Iranian government truly believes in protecting the Iranian people. It cares for the welfare of the Iranian people. So they're looking at a situation where, you know, their citizens are suffering. There's nothing they can do to protect it. Look what they did back at, again, I got in trouble with Mr. Mirandi once when I mentioned this, but I know my history. The Iraqis fired 189 missiles into Tehran and other cities during the War of the Cities back in 1988-89. And Ayatollah Khomeini had said, you know, we're in it for good. Saddam's got to go. The end of it, we're never going to stop till Saddam's gone. And then he had to drink that bitter cup of poison to make a peace because they had no other choice. Why? Because the people of Tehran were fleeing. They were helpless. There was nothing they could do to stop this. And I believe that was the situation that confronted this government. And it's something I told Mr. Mirandi will happen. That the damage that will be done to Iran will be such that they will be compelled to drink a bitter cup of poison and seek a peace, that Iran's not going to achieve what it wants to achieve. It doesn't mean that I didn't want Iran to achieve it. I personally would like to see Iran break Israel's back, but apparently that wasn't in the cards. Israel was able to inflict damage on Iran. And Iran was also looking at a potential escalation that could bring in more American military power that would bring even more damage to Iran. So I think Trump didn't want to do that. Trump didn't want to get sucked into a long-lasting regional war. And so I think they both were able to come to a common sense saying the Iranians, we don't want to be bombed. And Trump saying, we really don't want to bomb you. And so ceasefire. We won't know until both sides open up the books and start telling us what really happened. But we can speculate.
In both cases, you mentioned the war with Iraq and with Israel. Both countries attacked Iran. Iran didn't attack these countries. They started attacking Iran, and Iran had to respond, had to fight with them. But what has happened since then? Many people somehow thought that the Iranian people would, as you saw, not Netanyahu, it was Naftali Bennett, all his administration were talking about it. The people in Iran would rise up and would overthrow the government in Iran, and everything in the aftermath of killing the commanders, everything going to be destroyed. It's somehow, I said it before, we talk about it before, it was delusional to think of it. Because they know the nature, the tradition, the culture of Iranian people. They may disagree. Every night they gather, they talk to each other, they criticize each and every part of the government, each and every part of the government in Iran. But after all, when something comes in and something is fighting them, they're going to unite. It was somehow, and it wasn't just Israel and the United States talking this way. Look at the way that they were using the positions in the United States and outside Iran. They were somehow so much delusional about regime change in Iran.
Well, regime change is you say delusional, but let's reflect on it for a minute. Saddam Hussein, gone. Bashar al-Assad, gone. Nasrallah, gone. The Sudanese leader, gone. So now I've successfully eliminated many of these leaders. And am I delusional now to believe that maybe if we applied the same strategies, the tactics and all that, that we couldn't get regime change in Iran? I mean, you know, let's be honest. How many people thought that Bashar al-Assad in September of 2023 was vulnerable to total collapse? Wasn't on my bingo card. Was it on yours? No. But it happened because of the gradual erosion of Syrian society and Syrian leadership and all this stuff. I'm not saying that's the situation in Iran. In fact, I believe the exact opposite. I've mentioned several times, you know, the meeting with Raisi in September of 2023, when he opened up the conversation by talking about the events of the summer of 2023. He called it the greatest threat to the survival of the revolution of the Islamic Republic, because of the unrest that was done by the Western powers and other powers trying to use these various elements within Iran to bring down the government. He said, but we survived and we became stronger from it. The government has learned many lessons, but the people rallied around the government and we are stronger from it. So my belief is that if you attack Iran today, the people will once again rally around the government. But you know, you just never know the psychology of nations, what holds a nation together is an unquantifiable. At some point in time, all societies have the potential of collapse. But I don't believe the conditions were met here to do that. But I can't say it's delusional to imagine the possibility of bringing down Iran. And they continue to believe it. I'll say this. When Saddam Hussein, when the war ended in 1991, and they unleashed the inspectors on Iraq, that was supposed to be about containing Saddam. And indeed, the United States viewed it as a mechanism to get rid of Saddam, to starve his nation through sanctions, never letting sanctions to be lifted, even if Iraq complied with its disarmament obligation. But the Israelis weren't patient enough. The Israelis believed that Saddam represented an existential threat. Plus, they had vindictive hearts. And immediately after the war ended in March of 1991, the new head of Israeli military intelligence, Yuri Segei, put forward a plan to the Israeli leadership and said, we need to kill Saddam. The only way we'll ever be secure is to kill Saddam, regime change. That's it. And they began moving on that plan. In November of 1993, they're ready to act on it. They had an assassination plan ready to implement. Adnan Khalilah was in a Jordanian hospital under life support because of diabetes. The Israeli Mossad was in the hospital. They could kill him at will. And when they killed him, they already knew what the funeral arrangements would be. Khalilah would be brought back to Baghdad, mourning, taken to Tikrit. Saddam would fly in and there would be a funeral. And they knew the layout of Auja, where that was take place. They knew where the family plot was. And they had Sariat Matkal team that was going to fly in and have these special missiles. And as Saddam came in, they'd fire the missiles and they'd kill Saddam and then they'd escape. Plan was there. Going to happen. Not hypothetical. Going to happen. The final rehearsal went south. They fired live missiles into the car carrying the soldier pretending to be Saddam. Ironically, the driver and everybody around him died, but the guy pretending to be Saddam was just injured. But the point is they canceled that hit, but that didn't mean that they were done with Saddam. They said, okay, that's done, but we will continue to focus on his removal. And it wasn't until literally I intervened and met with Yuri Segei in October of 1994 and convinced him to stop the regime change and focus on containing Saddam through supporting the work of the inspectors, that the Israelis shifted. And the interesting thing about that is once Israel bought into the inspection process and supported it and worked to make it viable, the threat assessment of Saddam dropped from number one threat to number eight threat, number six or number eight. My memory is eluding me at the time, but it was low. But they also, I remember talking to the guy that was, he was a colonel and his job was to be Saddam. His job was to think like Saddam. And he's the guy that said, Saddam is an irrational actor. We have to kill him, da, da, da. But by the time I finished working with him about the reality of Iraq, Saddam was seen as a rational actor that Israel could peacefully coexist with so long as Saddam didn't have access to weapons of mass destruction. And so I bring that up for two reasons. One, I'm convinced today that Israel is vindictive and they continue to hold on to regime change fantasies. That even though Israel accepted this ceasefire, they want to kill Ali Khamenei and they want to kill the president And they are actively conspiring to do that. If the opportunity comes up for them to kill these leaders, they will kill these leaders and not worry about where the chips fall, just like they were going to do in 1993, kill Saddam. But I'm also convinced that if a viable plan backed by the United States to contain Iran's nuclear ambitions is put on the table, that the regime change fantasy can be put aside as it was in 1994. So, you know, past is precedent, and let's see what happens. You know, the regime change fantasy went away in 94, but it regrew in 2002, 2003. The whole purpose of the invasion of Iraq was to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and the Israelis backed that. Why? Because it's not that we couldn't contain Iraq with weapons inspections. We clearly could, but that the United States itself was never able to deviate from the regime change track. And here I'm worried, because here I see Lindsey Graham on the Senate floor talking about regime change. I see President Trump tweeting stupid things about regime change. And I'm just wondering if at the foundation of American policy, that this whole talk about stability is just a subterfuge for regime change. And people say, well, why would you believe that? Well, I don't know, because the United States set the Iranians up for negotiations. It was subterfuge for a knockout blow to kill their leadership. I mean, that's a big deal. This isn't like a minor thing. It's not like, you know, a coach giving a, you know, a bunt sign, you know, oh gosh, we shouldn't have bunt. We should have swung. No, this is about your entire approach to the game, the players you recruit, the training you do. Regime change was built into the very beginning of this operation. The success of this operation depended on regime change. And that wasn't just Israel signing off. That was America signing off. So I don't think we've walked away from the regime change policy. And this is why it's very important that we get other nations to jump in. The United States cannot be in control of this. Other nations have to come in and get a nuclear deal on the table that meets the satisfactions of the Iranians and demonstrates that the problem of Iran, as defined by a potential nuclear threat, is a containable problem, and therefore stop the regime change nonsense.